succession number 13242, reel 3.
Mr. Wharton, reel 3.
Well, the Japanese raider that was supposed to be in the vicinity, and we were going to go into it with, had we sighted it, with guns blazing and cover ourselves in glory, and father would get another medal. But fortunately, it didn't turn out that way. But going across the Indian Ocean in up towards the Arabian Sea, this particular day, the second mate on watch had sighted this whale. It was a whale that had been captured, but Durban, of course, was a whaling port, and their whale catchers used to go all over the Indian Ocean around the area to catch where they caught the whales. They'd harpoon a whale, then they'd blow it up with compressed air and everything, and stick a flag on it and leave it for the whale chaser to for her to collect at night and tow back to the whaling station on the bluff there at Durban. But this one was floating there with its little flag on, and the second mate sighted it, and at first he thought it was a submarine. It looked rather like a submarine, actually. And of course the old man comes up on the bridge there, and he's, I think he'd had one or two Duggan's Dew or whatever, and he saw this thing and immediately thought it was a submarine. So he went for full ahead and gave the helm orders to ram the damn thing. Well, we hit it fair and square amidship. And there was a great kind of a sound of air coming out, and the whole of the foredeck from the forecastle head way back beyond number one hatch was covered in putrid whale meat, which was stank to high heaven. Ah, goodness me. And anyway, when we got into Colombo, by then, of course, with the Japanese being in the war, it was a hive of activity. The really incredible Navy, the Royal Indian Navy, who had some of the most weird-looking craft, river steamers and whatnot, that had been hastily commandeered and taken over and as coastal escorts and whatnot. Later on in the war, of course, they became a wonderful navy. But from there, we went round to Trincomalee, where our main cargo of ammunition was for. And as we lay in Trincomalee Harbour, it's very, some people compare it in some ways with Scapa Flow. It's a huge expanse of water there, and could contain the whole of the Eastern Fleet. Well, a few months after we'd been there, of course, there was a Japanese raid which sank the Hermes and sank the Dorchester off the and one of the city boats just down the coast, City of Paris, I think it was, and then the harbour became untenable, really, and the Eastern Fleet was transferred over to Mombasa. And at the time we were there, though, we were discharging ammunition, and I thought to myself how wonderful it would be if I could be on some kind of a depot ship that just lay there in that harbour for the rest of the war. Wonderful. But I'm afraid I nearly had my wish. It more or less came that way. Anyway, when from there we loaded up to Calcutta, and we loaded pig iron again, being a cargo to down in the bottom of the holds, which and the usual jute and tea and whatnot, and came back home to the UK. And then I left the Clan Nine, and I went up for my second mate's ticket in Liverpool. And I had about 4 or 5 months ashore, and then I joined the pool. The pool at that time was, if you weren't, the company, of course, had been losing ships, and the pool were Empire-built ships. Empire ships were either captured tonnage or newly built tonnage, or the Americans, the Liberties and the Samboats and whatnot, the Victories came later. But I was to join this one of Larinagas. Well, Larinaga was the Larinaga family in Liverpool were dated back. It was a Spanish firm, really. But a lot of the crew were Spaniards. A lot of the officers, a lot of the captains were Spaniards, but naturalized British subjects. They'd been sailing out of Liverpool for so long. And it was very much a family company. The Larinaga family in Liverpool were very, very well known. And I was instructed to join the ship. I joined the Empire Mersey, that's right, down in Southampton.
This was the Larinaga ship, was it?
This is the Empire Mersey, which had originally been the Raymond de Larinaga. And I went down to Southampton to join her, and it was at, she was lying at number 10 berth. She was a ship, she was 5,791 gross tonnage, and she was about 450 feet in length. She was completed, built in March 1920 by Duncans of Port Glasgow, and triple expansion engines. And a sister ship was the Tellus Fora de Larinaga, and she was a three-deck ship built originally for carrying cotton from the American Gulf ports to the UK. But of course, with the exigency of the war years and whatnot, it was a case of carrying whatever was needed most in the emergency. And previous to my joining her, when she was still called the Raymond Larinaga, she had sailed from Philadelphia in February 1941, on the 7th of February 1941, with a cargo of 8,000 tons of pig iron aboard, bound for the UK. And it wasn't a very suitable cargo for a three-deck ship, with the prospect of a winter crossing of the North Atlantic in view. And the outcome of this departure was shortly after she'd, on February the 8th, they got a signal from the master giving a position 75 miles off the Jersey coast that her cargo had shifted. She was leaking badly and with the decks awash. This was in a northeast storm, and the lifeboats had been launched. US Coast Guard cutters went to her assistance, and she was escorted into the shelter of the Delaware Breakwater. And tugs finally beached her there on the Marshall Shoal. And on the 9th of February, she capsized, she turned turtle. And 47 members of the crew were saved. One man was missing, and one of the crew members had a broken leg. And she would have been given up as a constructive total loss, but owing to the wartime years, you know, they would salvage anything that floated. And an arrangement was made with the firm Merritt Chapman and Scott, and they to salve the vessel and the cargo on a Lloyd's form of contract. It was anticipated that the salvage operation would take 90 days. Well, they had a lot of adverse weather, and they managed to remove the plates from her side, and they discharged the cargo into barges, and hoping to float the vessel with the remainder of the cargo still in a hole. But she was full of mud, and they got it out eventually, and she was going to be towed when they came up, when they got her up, she had a 58 degree list, and the damage and the repairs, it was so extensive, the repairs amounted to some $420,000, and the estimated time to repair her was 120 days. And it was decided to tow her to Montreal and repair her during the winter season. But this plan, it was dropped because owing to the limited number of tugs suitable for towing, it was decided to have the repairs, they carried them out under the lease land. And as part of the repairs and the alterations, they fitted a helicopter platform, an autogyro, with no helicopters then, it was an autogyro, as part of the anti-submarine equipment on the stern of the vessel, and this took the form of a raised flight deck which extended from the mainmast to overhang the stern. And needless to say, an autogyro never appeared on the ship, and we used to ride around on bicycles on it. And on completion, she was now owned by the Ministry of War Transport, and they renamed her the Empire Mersey. And after loading a general cargo, a master was appointed from another ship that had been lost, and she returned to the UK discharging a cargo at Southampton. And when I joined her, she was destined to another voyage to the States. I joined her in the capacity of third mate, and the first impressions coming along the quay, that I was looking at an aircraft carrier with the flight deck overhanging the stern. But I was to find out later the adverse effect that this flight deck had on steering when there were any high winds around. From Southampton, we went to Cardiff as a final loading port, and we went to the convoy assembly point, which was at Milford Haven, and as we were sailing into there, we got this signal from the Port War signal station that flashed across to us, a query as to whether or not we had a certain rating on board this ship, and given his name and his number. And we required, you know, in the affirmative, and then the end of message, and that was it. We didn't hear any more. But more was to come at a later date. Anyway, we went across the Western Ocean, and with the exception of two depth charge attacks on suspected contacts, the voyage was without incident, excepting, of course, when we got off the Newfrey Banks. There was thick fog, which was prevalent at that time of the year, and maintaining station by means of a fog buoy streamed astern by the ship ahead. Well, it was one of the so-called delights of watchkeeping in one day, and you had to keep a very keen lookout. Well, the first port we got into was Boston, and of the whaling and the Tea Party fame in the olden days. And lying at anchor there were numerous ships, it being a convoy assembly port, and they were all flying their numeral flags indicating the positions in the convoy they were going to join. And adding to this colourful scene were the American holidaymakers who were chugging around the harbour in pleasure boats taking pictures of this lot ad lib, and security left a lot to be desired. Anyway, these were all river and lake steamers, paddle and otherwise, have been fitted with weather bows on account of their low lying in the water, and they were destined, on account of the shallow draft, to become landing craft or troop carriers for the forthcoming second front in the UK. But I believe a German wolfback and some very heavy weather put paid to that exercise. And then, as we went from Boston, we went through the Cape Cod Canal up Martha's Vineyard to the East River and to New York and Staten Island. And the tide was running against us going up the East River, and if you can imagine, as we passed under the famous Brooklyn Bridge, we'd four tugs strapped either side to assist us in breasting the current. Our speed, full speed, was 5 knots. And even you know, with the assistance of the tugs, we barely made any appreciable distance over the ground. And when we got into Staten Island, the first two characters who came aboard proved to be FBI agents. And they promptly took away under an escort the rating concerned with the message that had come from the Port War signal station at Milford Haven. His story, we found out later, had been recounted to his shipmates, had been one of fatalistic resignation by the fact that once he was back in the States, he'd be picked up. And he knew nothing, really, of the signal that had been flashed across at Milford. But seemingly, back in the days of the hair-raising days of Prohibition, he'd been engaged in the very lucrative game of rum-running. And after being caught, he was convicted to a hefty term of penal servitude in a penitentiary in Los Angeles. And while being taken there, he dived out of the train window, and he made good his escape. He found his way to Australia, where he took over the identity and the papers of a deserter from the Australian Navy. This would be back, I should think, in 1932 time. And finishing his service there with exemplary conduct, he then joined the MN. And due to wartime conditions, of course, he became involved in the pool, and hence the trip back to the States. It was his first visit back for 10 years. Yes, 10 years, 1932. Anyway, there, after loading a typical wartime cargo of leased-land goods, flour and dried eggs, cheese, spares and various other war material, we were chopping up the spaces in the top of the hatch comb, in number 3 hatch, with big cheeses, big round cheeses. And one of our Liverpool firemen, they were hard case, but they were good at their job, aided and abetted by his mates, he tried to pinch one of these cheeses and caught in the act. I caught him in the act. And he gave me a very choice selection from his Liverpool vocabulary. Anyway, before loading was completed, we'd stowed on board on the top of number 1, 2 and 4 hatches, 2 LCTs in sections. New York then at this time was a wonderful run ashore, and no blackout in the land of plenty. The hospitality was terrific. Greenwich Village, the Coney Island, Jack Dempsey's Bar, the Stork Club. Anyway, before long, it was time to read the draft, test the gear, and rig the wireless aerial, pilot aboard, and stations for leaving harbour. The convoy we eventually joined was SC-104, and I know the ships that were in the convoy, but out of the ships in the convoy, the following were torpedoed and sunk: the Phagistan, the Ashworth, the Nellie, Southern Empress, one of Salverson's of Leith, a wheel factory ship, the Empire Mersey, that's us, and the Susanna and the Nikolina Matakovich and Center. And heading up across the Gulf of Maine, we were going bound up for Halifax, and out into the depth of the Atlantic, we made our way off the Nova Scotian coast. Just off Halifax, we picked up a distress signal from a merchant ship. She'd evidently anchored in the harbour. She was on fire with a full cargo of explosives on board. And I thought back to the days in terms of a disaster that happened there in the last war, when the munition ship blew up and just about flattened Halifax. And you could imagine the predicament of all the people in Halifax, the predicament that they were concerned in. However, our convoy was doggedly plodded its weary way. The speed was 5 knots, weather permitting, and we ran into the tail end of a West Indian hurricane, which had recurved to the northeast on reaching more temperate latitudes. It was something to be imagined, with a gale force 10 and a confused and dangerous sea, with white spume being blown across the crest of the waves. By the time the convoy was in the danger area, known as the pit, which at this particular time of war, It wasn't covered by any shore-based aircraft, and we had at that time no escort carriers. Being a merchant ship, the information regarding enemy movements didn't come our way, just barring the usual laconic reports to close up the convoy and keep station. The enemy submarines are known to be in the vicinity. With the publication of facts after the war, it was possible to trace the chain of events from the enemy point of view.
Can you give me your own personal memories of the convoy and how the Empire Mersey was sunk?
Yes, the going, you know, looking back in retrospect, and if my memory serves me correctly, the first attack on the convoy was when the U-221 torpedoed the first three ships, and it was just as if an inferno had been let loose. The opening scenes of the Red Distress rockets climbing up into the dark sky from the sinking ships, and suddenly then the whole of the sky is lit up by the eerie glow of the snowflake rockets fired both by escorts and merchant ships alike. The explosion of gunfire as escorts fired star shell, and adding to this was the thunder and crash of the exploding depth charges. Passing by the wreckage left by one ship, we could see the red lights on the life jackets of the men in the water, but we had to steam on regardless and keep station. The next day, the weather, it did abate a bit, and there was still a heavy sea running, and night time came with a certain prospect of further attacks. Our life jackets and panic bags full of small sentimental value were kept ready to hand. Comes the second night of the attack, and our position was on the starboard side of the convoy, one of the last ships bringing up the rear of the outer column. We all agreed it was just a matter of time, and while some watched that night, my watch was the 8 to 12, I had cause, as the officer of the watch, to call attention to the erratic steering being carried out by the helmsman. Granted, the weather conditions and the flight deck aft didn't help the vessel much, let alone our turn of speed. But all I got was a mouthful of invective from a hard case AB. And I thought to myself, well, it must be the old man's report in the morning. However, fate intervened. When the first ship went, it was over the far side of the convoy, and we secretly blessed our luck. However, this was short-lived, and when the Southern Empress went up, it was all hell let loose. She was a whale factory ship owned by Salvesons of Leith, normally employed in the Antarctic, but on this occasion was returning to the UK with a cargo of case oil aboard, a highly dangerous cargo. Also on board, by fate of circumstances, were a party of 75 DBS, distressed British seamen. They were survivors from other British ships sunk in previous convoys, and going back to the UK after being landed in the States. She was like a huge molten furnace that broke out incandescent, a fire from truck to keel with flames and oil pouring over into the wild sea. It lit up the convoy area for miles around. From a distance, the further ships, they looked so small against the gale-torn stretch of water, and they were heaving and pitching in the heavy seas. The screams and cries for help as we passed her by were soon drowned by the thunder of the exploding depth charges as contact was made with the enemy. My watch was over, but who could go down below for a rest? It seemed pointless because we knew we were going to get the hammer. So with the second and third sparks, we discussed life and the events in the radio room above the bridge. And about 02:30 in the morning, a most demoralising time on the morning of the 14th of October, in a position latitude 54 long north, longitude 40 degrees 15 west, some 400 miles southwest of Cape Farewell, Greenland, the Empire Mersey finally and undeniably met her fate. Well, the ship, there was an almighty bang and a crash, and the ship shuddered and she lurched over to port, and we later found out this was two torpedoes that had hit us, and she was going down fast by the head, and the old man Captain Bastarica, he was a naturalized British subject, he gave the order to abandon ship. And my boat was down on the water, just going down almost on the water when somebody did let go the inadvertently the phone the forward fall was let go, and of course the boat upended and the lot were flung into the water. And at that time of the year in October, that part of the Atlantic, it was cold to say the least. Fortunately, I was wearing at the time I had a pair of long johns on, I had a pair of uniform trousers and a uniform jacket, I had a sweater, I had my greatcoat, and I had my life jacket made fast on top, and I had a pair of half leather sea boots. And of course I was when I was in the water, the waterline between in the trough between the two waves, it seemed just to be up to the bottom of my nose. And I kicked off my boots, I ripped off my panic bag there with all my I remember a lovely silver cigarette case that my mother had given to me for my 21st birthday. And I ripped this off and just, you know, was paddling about, and I thought, well, sugar this, you know, do something to save yourself. And I started to try to swim. Well, I fortunately, more by good luck than anything else, I got washed alongside this, what they call a French letter, which was a canvas bag containing the mast and the sail for my lifeboat, and it afforded quite a bit of support. And there was one of the ordinary seamen clinging on there with me, and how he was, I don't know, because he only had on a short-time vest. And anyway, we more by good luck than fortune, we got washed alongside the second mate's boat. And the second mate's boat, it was full of survivors, but she was coming up in the trough of the on the crest of the waves and lurching over. And when they were trying to pull me over the side, I was too heavy, I was too waterlogged. And he said, oh, push him back, you know, push him back. And this same AB the same fireman I caught with the cheese there back in New York, he said, no, he said, you can't let the poor bastard drown. He said, pull him in, pull him in. So anyway, they gave a heave and I flopped down in the gunnels of the boat and I promptly passed out, you know, due to cold and the whole lot. And when I came to, I could hear all the whistles being blown and everything, and there was this rescue ship, the Gotland, one of Curry's of Leith, and I believe I found out afterwards it was a Captain Haddon, OBE, who had done some wonderful work in rescue ships. These were only small ships, really, ships built for just the continental coastal work. And the Admiralty fitted them out as rescue ships. As we got near to her, she was coming astern to make a lee to pick us up, and you could see the propeller thrashing away, and you know, her stern came out of the water, and for one horrible moment we thought the boat was going to be smashed up and churned in under the propeller. But we got alongside and they had scrambling nets down the side, and of course one or two people made a